I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, a powerful El Niño may be developing, potentially strong enough to reshape weather patterns around the world. What could this so-called super El Niño mean for Texas? Could it bring heavier rainfall, flooding, and severe storms? And how might it affect hurricanes, heat waves, agriculture, and food prices across the United States and around the world? We'll hear what the latest forecasting models are showing and how a warming planet may be amplifying weather extremes. We'll also examine why this research matters and what could be lost if federal weather agencies, climate monitoring systems, and university science programs were weakened or underfunded. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Texas is experiencing another summer of weather whiplash, destructive rainfall and flooding, followed by dangerous heat. And now Tropical Storm Bertha is moving towards Texas across the Gulf of Mexico. Meanwhile, a strengthening El Niño could influence Texas weather for months to come. This is being called a super El Niño, and there is a super chance that it's going to disrupt weather patterns, including here in South and Central Texas. And it could be another sign that we have the impact of global warming. We're going to be talking about today also about the need to fully fund the science that studies global weather and climate. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. With us today, we're joined by Judson W. Parton. He is a research associate professor at the Institute of Geophysics, Jackson School of Geoscience, and at the University of Texas at Austin. And Judd, welcome to The Source.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Sylvia D., a professor and climate scientist at Rice University, specializing in climate change in the past, present, and the future of Earth's hydrological cycle. And Sylvia D., welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Jana Infitali is with us, a meteorologist at NOAA and National Weather Service Climate Prediction Center. Jana Infitali, welcome to The Source.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So we're going to be talking about Super El Niño, and what is that? So El Niño Grande, Judson, what is that?
You can just call me Judd. Appreciate it. Super is more used in the media. Only a couple groups really use it in science. So I'll probably say like extreme or strong. But it just means that there's a large body of warm water in the central tropical Pacific that normally isn't there. And when it's there, it reroutes winds and ocean currents and downstream a lot of rainfall changes.
And Sylvia, this is a naturally occurring phenomenon that happens with some regularity. And I know we hear about Super El Niño and La Niña. And so is this just part of weather and climate?
Yeah, so we know that El Niño and La Niña events have happened for thousands of years. However, we also see in the 20th century and in the last 25 years that the statistics of El Niño and La Niña events are changing. So while the El Niño Southern Oscillation, which produces these events every 2 to 7 years, have happened naturally in the climate system, again, for a very long time, the changes we're seeing in the types of events we're having, their strength, their patterns of warming are changing with global warming.
Jana Infantati, what do we know for sure? What's certain?
So right now, we are currently under an El Niño advisory, which just means that El Niño conditions are officially present in both the ocean and the atmosphere. And then in terms of the prediction, our latest forecast that was released on July 20th, we do expect that El Niño is going to continue strengthening through the end of the year. And we do have fairly high confidence, a 97% chance that El Niño will stick around through about the early spring of 2027.
And so, Joe, what does that mean for Okay, so climate, global weather, and then our local weather forecast. What does that mean? Well, how does it all come together? How is it going to impact this area?
Here in Texas, no El Nino or La Nina is exactly the same. The kind of the shape, the extent of the warm water in the tropical Pacific will dictate where the winds go. And so they're not all exactly the same. So you can kind of say on average, how do they impact things? And on average here in Texas, it tends to be a little cooler and wetter. Cool. And generally less tropical storms.
So cooler and wetter, I mean, like enough to make a difference? I mean, is it going to enough to like we'll have a bigger freeze or more extreme weather events? Or we just don't know, Sylvia D?
Yeah, so our extreme winter events tend to have to do with the polar jet stream dipping further south and bringing cold Arctic air. When we talk about El Nino and La Nina conditions for Texas and what it will do to the weather here, you know, on average, what we see, as Judd mentioned, is wetter and cooler conditions. The Gulf Coast, for example, sees above average rainfall in about 80% of historical El Nino events. So essentially, El Nino loads the dice towards a higher chance of higher rainfall and cooler temperatures. Now, that's not saying that temperatures are going to drop by 20 degrees all of next year, which would be awesome, but it's not going to happen, right? It just means that on average, maybe this year could be a little cooler. And then conversely, during La Nina, we would expect there to be warm and dry conditions. And, you know, specifically for folks living in our area and our weather, right, the translation to flood drought mitigating conditions is what people are really looking for with these events. We might have a higher risk of flooded structures or, you know, flooded agricultural lands in an El Nino year. And so that's something that we're keeping an eye on for the coming winter and spring.
Yeah, but that's looking at South Texas or the southern part of the United States. What about, you know, to the north of us, Jana?
So typically what we would see is a bit of a difference between the northern tier of the U.S. and the southern tier of the U.S. So the northern tier usually would see warmer temperatures, where the southern tier has those cooler temperatures or could have those cooler temperatures and more rainfall. Texas can be a little bit of an enigma when we're doing forecasting, but we do generally say that Texas could have above average rainfall in general. And that's actually what we're forecasting in much of our upcoming forecast for this coming winter during this El Nino season, is that much of Texas will have above average precipitation.
But Judd, in the northern part of the United States, I've seen the predictions saying it'll be a warmer and drier winter for these areas. And there's some concerns like that could bring about more wildfires and also be harsh on their crop growing in those parts. So this is good to think about. I'm trying to expand the scope here, looking at, here we are in South Texas, Central Texas dealing with this and we'll feel the effects. This is a global phenomenon. It's going to change weather patterns around the world, right?
That's correct. So it's centered in the tropical Pacific, which is a ways away from us. And when the warm water occurs there, it's like the size of the United States. It's huge. You fly over a plane. I've flown over many times. The Pacific's a big ocean. Now, the further you get away from that Pacific Ocean, it's like dominoes falling. So it's not as exact as places which are right there in the center of action. It's very predictable how they're going to respond because they're right next to where the event's happening. As you get further away, it gets harder and harder to tell. So the northern U.S., there's other things that come into play.
Right.
Could come into play.
Yeah.
It gets more difficult.
Okay, so we got to take a break here. When we come back from the break, I also want to talk about what this could mean around the world. We've seen the effects of super El Ninos before. And they have not been good for places like Africa and Australia. We'll get into that when we come back. And our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you have a question or a comment about Super El Nino, what's happening with our weather and climate change. Love to get your questions on the air, 833-877-8255. Source continues right after this.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. NOAA says El Nino is already underway and it's strengthening. They've assigned a 97% probability that El Nino will persist through early spring 2027, an 81% probability that it will reach the very strong category, which what they call is, some people call, maybe in the media, we assign that the tag Super El Nino category. And that's going to be going through October through December of this year. This could have change our weather quite a bit. And, you know, you can't do anything about the weather, but you can prepare. And at least we should understand what is happening and what is the impact. What does climate change have to do with that? You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Infanti, if you could tell me about how, you know, the Prediction Center looks at these types of issues. You see a Super El Nino's out there. What does that mean for what y'all do?
Sure. So as Sylvia had said before, we kind of think of an El Nino, even a strong El Nino, as being something that can tilt the odds or stack the deck towards a certain set of outcomes. Nothing is ever necessarily a guarantee, but it is something that we consider as we're going through our forecasts. So we would look at things like the strength of that El Nino and some of the typical things that have happened during those El Nino events in the past, and we will use those to inform our upcoming forecasts. We may have some uncertainty that's given that we include in our forecast, given some of the other tools that we use, which will include dynamical climate models and, you know, forecasts of the upcoming couple seasons. But we consider it as a key player as in some of our forecasts, but in a way that is more stacking the deck or loading the die and can lead to some typical impacts rather than necessarily guaranteed impacts.
Right. So Sylvia D., looking at it from people who are concerned about global warming and climate change, which should be everyone. I mean, how do we've had Super El Ninos before, I mean, going back 100 years, but we're having more of them? It seems to be happening more frequently. Is that true? Is that, and could that be evidence that climate change is real?
So that's a very complicated question, and I'm really glad you asked it. There's a huge body of research that is still extremely active on exactly how El Nino events are changing with global warming. So right now, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which summarizes all the data, shows that our best climate models, and you know, something like 50 of them, don't necessarily agree on how climate change is going to affect El Nino and La Nina events. However, if we look over the past 100 years, as you mentioned, we are seeing changes in the frequency and the intensity of El Nino events. You know, certainly these big super El Nino events, as we're calling them, or very strong, seem to be occurring with more frequency. And there are also changes in the extent of warming. So as Judd mentioned, the tropical Pacific is this massive, enormous heat engine to the atmosphere. It dramatically affects our weather and climate globally. And the tropical Pacific itself is warming up over time. And so essentially we have this slow moving increase in global temperatures and Pacific temperatures. And then on top of that, we're getting this increase in temperatures from El Nino. So you can imagine, we've used this loading the dice analogy a couple times now, if we are increasing the temperature within El Nino on top of an already hotter tropical Pacific Ocean, you're getting a bigger hammer on the rest of the climate system.
And so let me go to a caller, 833-877-8255, if you want to call in. And Jennifer, Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi. As regards to the ocean warming, I know there's a big dead zone off the mouth of the Mississippi River in the Gulf. Would the strong El Nino be able to break that up?
All right, Jennifer, thank you for that call. That strong dead zone is usually a result of so much fertilizer coming from the Midwest and traveling down the Mississippi and jumping into the Gulf of Mexico. We have algae blooms. They suck up a lot of oxygen and creates that dead zone. But is there any connection to, could that be breaking up? Judd, can you tell me anything about that?
I wouldn't assume anything could happen with the dead zone because it's driven by chemical changes. If you wanted to think about a couple dominoes that could fall, generally with an El Nino, there's less vertical wind shear across the Atlantic and the Gulf. And so vertical wind shear is like the difference between the upper and low level winds, kind of like the bully in school that would like trip your feet and hit your shoulders, get you in two directions and you fall down. So that's what's happening with Bertha right now. The wind shear's tearing it up. So you can't get like that beautiful eye wall of doom that rolls through the vertical eye wall. So it tears it and breaks it. So why I would mention that is because the wind could actually mix. And so if the wind does mix in the Gulf, then there is the possibility of bringing up some oxygen. But that's like a lot of dominoes to fall. Those are, like you said, they're related, but not exactly next to each other.
Right. So these tropical storms or hurricanes, they have to be stacked. Have to have, you know, the vertical stacked. And if the wind shear is strong, then that doesn't happen. And so it's not able to develop a nice, organized, you know, system. Is that what you're saying?
Right, right. Like the pinwheel, where you see the eye of the hurricane and the vertical walls going up into, you know, way high up in the atmosphere when the plane flies through. That gets torn apart high and low. And that's what happened with Bertha. And that's what tends to happen during El Nino years, which is why, in general, we have fewer tropical storms during El Ninos.
Sylvia D., looking at the global picture of what this super El Nino could mean, in past years, we've seen it cause extreme droughts in places like Australia and Africa, also extreme coral die-offs because of the warming temperature in some of these areas. So this is really a global story, and there could be a lot of consequences from what happens. What are people going to be looking for?
Yeah, so what we're concerned about, as you mentioned, there are global impacts in the Western tropical Pacific. We tend to see increased risk of drought, fire, and then in the Eastern Pacific areas like, you know, Southern California, we tend to see an elevated risk of extreme rainfall, landslides. I was actually in Los Angeles in 1998 when there was significant flooding all over the city from that super El Nino. And so, you know, this is really causing on the ground impacts for people all over the United States. You know, further afield, as you mentioned, in Africa, in areas like the Sahel, which is known as sort of the breadbasket or the main agricultural production region, we expect severe droughts. And then simultaneously, we tend to see a lot of rainfall and flooding and outbreaks of disease in East Africa. So, right, we're looking at big, widespread disruptions to agriculture, electricity production that's needed or that you need fresh water to essentially cool, and then direct infrastructure risks from fire and flooding. So one other thing I'll mention, we actually just had a paper come out that was looking at the relationship between armed conflict and El Nino. And we've also seen pretty strong evidence that El Nino can actually exacerbate outbreaks of civil violence and violent conflict. So that's another thing I'll personally be watching for is with this super El Nino and some of the strong drought conditions in particular that it brings across Africa and in the South Pacific. Will that contribute to, you know, any changes in the conflicts we see around the world?
And that's because the disruption of the expected weather patterns, the disruption to, you know, being able to have successful crops and harvest, that disrupts societies and you have outbreaks of violence.
Absolutely. So disruptions to agriculture and water supply can directly change people's livelihoods and contribute to violence.
And then you think about globally, we're having the reduction in availability of fertilizer, also the elimination of USAID in these areas. We've already have 6 major conflicts happening across Africa. There's already it's like a powder keg. You have to wonder about that. We're going to take a break for our TPR pledge drive. We're going to come back and talk more about El Nino and fully funding the science behind all this so we can understand what is happening and maybe do better as these complications arise. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Jen White from 1A. When the world convulses in fits of violence and tragedy as it seems to do regularly, there are very few places where we, the people, can convene in a deliberate way and have a national conversation whose goal is simply to make space for people to process. It's a sacred space that doesn't exist of its own volition. It requires resources, time, effort, patience, creativity, not just from the show staff and the host, but from you. You're the person who can donate now to keep this space alive and growing. Because you listen and get tangible, valuable information on a daily basis, please take a moment to make your donation today. Here's how.
And you can give us a call at 800-622-8977 to make your gift today. You can go to tpr.org or go through the TPR app and hit on the red button and click through and figure out what's an appropriate gift, what works for your budget, and become a member of Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, and you're listening to the Texas Public Radio Summer Fundraising Drive. And right now, during this conversation on The Source, we're talking about Super El Nino and what it could mean for global weather patterns, what it could mean for South Texas and Central Texas. We've already seen some severe weather, this last week. And, Texas Public Radio was covering that. But what I want to focus on is how Texas Public Radio, in The Source and other programming that we have, we want to focus on the science, focus on the facts, really try to explain what is happening in the world. You are not disconnected from the weather. We are all connected to that. And having a better understanding of our world is part of our mission, help you understand why these things are happening. And they're not random. It's not chance. There are things that can be done either to, we can't control the weather, but we can control the conditions that may have led to this. And also we can prepare as we understand what is happening. And this is why we need good science. And we're talking about that today. If you appreciate good science, if you want to have science fully funded and protected and stay independent, give us a call, 800-622-8977. And with me now to tell you more is Rebecca Cavan, our TPR Director of Development. Hey.
Hi, Dave. Thanks. Well, you're so right. We are connected as a community, and we see that during these fundraising drives when everybody comes together to help us achieve sort of a large goal to make the programming that everyone's relying on happen. We started the summer drive with about $250,000 to raise. We're down to less than $112,000 to go over the next couple of days, or just in today. If everybody wanted to pitch in right now, we could wrap it up by the end of this day. If this is a time you can give, it's a great time to do it. It's very easy. It's just a seamless process. You can go online to tpr.org. You can use our TPR app, or you can call 800-622-8977 to make your contribution right now.
We don't just report the weather and give you the weather updates and tell you, whether or not it's going to be 100 degrees today or not, and it will be. But we also report on the impacts of the weather when it comes to like the extreme flooding that we had recently and then last year. Also, we report on how the extreme heat in urban heat islands and how that affects workers and people who are outside all the time, the unhoused. This is an ongoing story. We have to recognize that these things are happening. You want reliable information to tell you what is going on in the world. That is what our Texas Public Radio newsroom is all about. We need the funding. We had our federal funding taken away last year, and Texas Public Radio was able to weather that storm, but that storm continues. We can't do it without you. We're raising that $250,000 from our listener community. Every gift is matched dollar for dollar. Make your gift today at tpr.org or through the TPR app, or get better at it. Give us a call, 800-622-8977. We'd love to hear what you got to say. Give me any comments that you like, or you could also tell them that Dave sent you. Rebecca.
I love it. This is such a, this program is such a encapsulation of what public radio does best, bringing in experts, panelists, discussions around topics that really matter to the community.
And so get the listeners involved.
Get the listeners involved. Y'all get to call in and talk about it. Tell Dave what you think about it, good, bad, or ugly. Get on the line now. Help us make this programming possible for everybody in the community. We really would appreciate it. And your dollar's going to go twice as far. Go to TPR.org, use our TPR app, or call us at 800-622-8977.
Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Super El Nino, also called a very strong El Nino. This is a reoccurring climate phenomenon resulting from the average sea temperature in parts of the Pacific Ocean, typically off of Chile, rising by 2 degrees Celsius or more. This affects the global weather patterns. Impacts can include widespread and severe flooding or drought, unseasonable temperature extremes that can result in crop failures, food shortages, famine, disruption to water supplies, displacement, decline in native fauna, and an increase of risk of wildfires. It could also contribute to economic disruption and civil conflict. As of this year, there have been about 5 super El Nino events in recorded history. So this is not brand new, but we might be seeing something brand new and compounded effects by the other global warming effects that we have here around the world. We're talking about that today, and you can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So Jed Parton, Research Associate Professor of Climatology at the University of Texas at Austin. The Trump administration has significantly weakened parts of the federal weather and climate research. They've done staffing reductions. They have grant cancellations. They have, tried to eliminate NOAA research arm in some effects. So it just seems like this is a bad time to be trying to reduce what we're actually being able to do in terms to monitoring this impact and being able to do weather forecasting. I mean, so what's your take on that?
Well, I'll confess I'm a little bit biased because I'm in the system. So, of course, I'm going to be like, oh, no, give me money. But beyond that.
All of you weather guys, that exactly. Sweet, sweet federal money.
Oh, yeah, we're living high on the hog, let me tell you. But in general, I can say that it just informs the public about what's going on. So we're spending all this money on weather satellites and balloons and stuff to get forecasts so we can prepare for our daily lives. It helps the farmers prepare for a drought or flooding to help with crops, water management resources with reservoirs. So it's to know what's coming isn't a bad thing. It's a good thing. It helps you prepare because El Nino, like you said, is natural. We have records going back to the last ice age. It was still around. It seems to be picking up and getting more frequent with global warming, and the impacts are getting stronger, like Sylvia said, as the Pacific warms. So it's reaching out and affecting more. So we should be informed and know if it's coming to be able to prepare for it.
So, Sylvia D., there were these National Science Foundation Ocean Observatory buoys that were in the ocean, about 900 of these surface buoys. They were in the ocean, they were measuring temperatures, currents, acidity, all sorts of important parts of what's happening in the ocean. The Trump administration tried to remove these buoys. I really don't understand why they wanted to do that. That was stopped through congressional action and also through the courts. So, I mean, are these buoys important to what you do, and would you want to see them remain?
Our ability to track what's happening across Earth's oceans is possibly the single most important thing that we have in terms of climate and weather prediction, because the atmosphere directly responds to what the ocean is telling it. And there is no shortage of examples that we've talked about already today or that I can provide about how our day-to-day weather and our weather forecasts directly impact our lives, our economy, our health. And so, you know, the requirement that we have and that the U.S. government has supported to have satellite data, in situ monitoring, those buoys, our National Weather Service weather stations, all the data that we are beaming down from space and collecting on the ground and in the oceans helps us better prepare and have accurate weather forecasts every single day. And that doesn't even bring in the people, right? The meteorologists and the physicists who are working tirelessly to get those predictions to the American people, to Texans, because we know how impactful our day-to-day weather changes can be on our lives. And so, you know, my comment on that is that I'm grateful that Congress stopped the removal of those buoys, because if we don't know what's happening across the tropical Pacific and the Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico, then we have no idea what's coming, right? We have to be able to see what's coming from the West, and the ocean tells us that story very clearly.
Jonna Infante, tell me about why the ocean is so significant, or even the Pacific Ocean, and, you know, the warming of it with the Super El Niño. How does that impact the global weather pattern? And I'm wondering about also, we know about this global conveyor belt of water, and you know, will this disrupt that?
So El Niño is, as I said in one of my other answers, one of the key things that we do look at for our forecasts. So in general, the El Niño Southern Oscillation, whether it's El Niño or La Niña, it's something that we do look at, particularly in the winter time. So one of the ways that this impacts the globe is because there's sort of a chain reaction that occurs that stems from El Niño or La Niña that can impact weather around the globe. And I know that it might seem counterintuitive that ocean temperatures that are miles and miles away could alter the weather patterns in some of the regions around the globe, but it's because of how El Niño or La Niña do impact the jet stream. And I believe this was said in one of the other answers, but one of the things that occurs is typically there's an area of thunderstorms over the Western Pacific. But during an El Niño, that area of warmer water shifts eastward, and that tropical rainfall does go along with it. And what that can do is that shift can cause an eastward extension and a strengthening of the jet stream. And those little wiggles in the jet stream and changes in the jet stream are what can impact the weather patterns worldwide, and including over the U.S. So we've already said this a few times, but during an El Niño, that the jet stream can then impact the southern tier of the U.S. with additional moisture, including Texas, which can bring cloudier and wetter winters than average. So that's, you know, one of the reasons that this is a really key player in some of our forecasts, you know, looking forward, is because of those impacts that we can see from those differences in the ocean temperatures in the equatorial Pacific.
Let's go to another caller. We have Richard on the line, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, if you want to call in. And Richard, hey, you're on The Source. Go ahead.
Hello there. I'm a science teacher and a scientist calling with a question about the models we use to predict and plan around weather changes. Is it possible that our models are not robust, or that they are time limited, so that with other calculations we might have a less pessimistic outlook on our future or our circumstances? Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that, Richard. So, Judd, we want to talk about the models.
Sure. So there's a few things going on there when you're talking about El Niño. First off, all the models agree the Earth's going to warm. The question is how much. Some are a little bit warmer, some are much warmer, but they're all warming. Pessimism, I agree. Things are way too pessimistic. All the dire and doom, 12 years, when it ends, that's a load of whatever. But what the models, so all models are wrong, but they're all useful. And so while they all get the warming right, where exactly they get the warming will give you the relative changes. So where you have the relative warmings is going to give you the H and the Ls, the highs and lows that you see on the weather forecast. Where those H and Ls, where those pressure changes are going to change the winds. Where the winds go is where the rainfall goes. And so if you have slight shifts on exactly where the warming occurs from model to model, they may not get something like El Nino correct well, we don't know what the future is going to be, but they won't agree with where the changes will go with warming.
I mean, this is extremely complicated.
Dude, it's the world, man.
Supercomputers cannot figure this out.
It's the world. I mean, you eat dinner every day, right? What are you going to have for dinner tonight?
Nothing.
Or tomorrow night. What are you going to have dinner December 2nd, right? And so, they're trying to predict the future. But again, we're talking about projections with probabilities and loading the dice because it's very difficult. And there's things that the models do correct and agree on. And so with regards to the collar, it's not as pessimistic as it seems. If we do some changes, we can help with the future, but there's still a big price tag to pay for our kids and our kids' kids.
I mean, but even the models that I saw for what's happening with the birth of the tropical storm in the Gulf, some of it has it going towards Texas, and there are a few that have it going off to Kansas City. I mean, it's just even something as in just a matter of days, they're in disagreement. You see the spaghetti models.
Yeah, it's a butterfly effect. You mentioned something about random stuff earlier. It's a butterfly effect. So small changes can add up to large changes. But that's weather. That's not climate. Climate is when you add that up for 30 years. And have there been more El Ninos for 30 or 40 years? Or what are the long-term changes? That's climate change.
But I'm making the comparison of complexity. And it's something that is relatively as simple as a tropical storm that's happening right now.
Well, I would tell you where it's going to be. It's not relatively simple.
But it gets even more complex, exponentially more complex when we're talking about climate models moving into the future that is a year from now, 50 years from now. But that's why we need better science.
Crazily enough, 50 years is easier than 1 year.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, we can talk about that when we come back. Our phone lines are open. If you've got a question or comment about weather prediction models, what can we expect in the future for the climate, and how this is all could impact you. I mean, this is going to really hit the world. And so we have to think about it and talk about it and invest in trying to figure this out. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We want to hear your questions and comments on The Source, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about Super El Nino, El Nino Mas Grande. It is happening in the Pacific Ocean. It is going to be changing weather patterns. We need to prepare now for what we think will happen. There's a lot of uncertainty about this, but we know it's going to happen. It will make an impact. And so if you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Sylvia D., could El Nino change the location and timing of a winter severe impacts? I mean, because we're talking about the jet stream. And the way I see the jet stream is kind of acts as like a wall. We see it keeping a lot of the frigid air north of the jet stream. And then and so during the wintertime, when we see the jet stream kind of weakening, it allows more a big blob of cold air to reach all the way down here into Texas. I mean, are these things all interconnected?
Yes, they are interconnected. So if we're thinking about winter weather in Texas, one of the things that we see during El Nino and especially strong El Nino events is that we can have some of the extreme thunderstorm activity that we usually get in Texas in the springtime during the winter. And so we sometimes see severe weather outbreaks and even tornadoes across the south central and the south central Great Plains and coastal Texas. And so these out-of-season severe weather outbreaks and tornadoes can be one of the things that this subtropical jet stream that's coming across the state can bring to us. In terms of, you know, you mentioned the winter storms, the polar jet and the subtropical jet and their position and strength are what really determine whether we get those big cold air, masses coming as far south as Houston. If we get those extreme winter storms like Uri a couple of years ago, And the position of the polar jet stream is it is impacted by El Nino, but it's also, you know, it's doing its own thing. The Arctic Oscillation, which is another weather and climate pattern that is natural and a mode of what we call internal variability in the climate system, also controls the movement of the polar jet and brings that Arctic air down south. So while we'll see, again, sort of cooler and wetter conditions brought through the state, more likely by the subtropical jet stream, those cold extreme events are not out of the question, and they occur somewhat separately from these El Nino-induced conditions.
John Infante, what are you going to be looking at to see, like, that's super El Nino doing its due? I mean, is there any part of the world or part of the United States where you say, okay, this is going to be a telltale event? What will you be looking for?
We look mainly at what the atmosphere is doing. If the atmosphere is responding in sort of a typical way that we would normally see by looking at past events, we use that as a sort of guide to what we might be able to see this upcoming season or winter. What Sylvia said is also true. We do also take a look at some of the other things that can happen in the system, like the Arctic Oscillation, usually a bit closer to when we're actually making the forecasts towards the winter months. But generally, we're looking at sort of the atmospheric signature that would be related to an El Nino event and if we're going to start seeing some of the impacts coming into play.
And Judd, what are you going to be looking for? Are there things that say, okay, extreme drought, bigger monsoons in India, or no monsoon in India? What can we expect from this?
A lot of my research concentrates on the Western tropical Pacific, and I've been there a lot, like got close friends there. And so I'll be looking to see what the drought conditions are, especially on the smaller islands where they're relying on rain catchment. I've been there in 2016 in a country called Vanuatu, and on the leeward side of the island, a lot of the cisterns were empty. There wasn't water. You have to go down to the river even to wash your clothes or take a bath or anything. And so, like, those smaller areas without big reservoirs, they get hit quick and hard by an El Nino. But luckily, with forecasting and with monitoring, people can get warned and prepare for it. That's the key.
Right. And so I guess that's happening?
Oh, yeah. Oh, the communication there is phenomenal. The Coconut Telegraph, right, goes through the islands real quick. People understand, like, oh, El Nino, El Nino. They know quickly.
Right. And so I'm wondering also here in the United States, in the Southwest, particularly around like Arizona, we've seen a big major drought. And I guess they could be hoping that the El Nino brings them a lot more water to refill some of the reservoirs and save them from overuse. So Sylvia D, could that happen?
You know, we do see some amount of reservoir recovery in the U.S. Southwest during El Nino. But unfortunately, if we look at the U.S. Drought Monitor, one of the figures I show my students at Rice is the Texas percent area in drought conditions. And essentially for their entire lifetimes from, you know, 2000 to 2026, Texas has been in a majority drought. And so even if we get a little bit of relief, you know, every 2 to 5 to 8 years with an El Nino event, unfortunately, in places like California, Arizona, and Texas too, our persistent drought conditions are being driven by the longer term, heating of global warming, the increase in the atmosphere's ability to hold more water vapor. And so the relief is likely temporary. And the other thing that's really damaging the water availability in the U.S. Southwest is the heavy withdrawals from groundwater and the heavy withdrawals from the Colorado.
Well, that's not going to change.
Right, exactly.
Sylvia D is a professor and climate scientist at Rice University. Jana Infante is a meteorologist at NOAA National Weather Service Climate Prediction Center. Judson Parton is a research associate professor of climatology at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank all of you for coming on board today, helping us understand the complex system we know as Super El Nino. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies.
Hi, I'm Kathy McNaughton.
And I'm Mike McNaughton.
We've been listening to Texas Public Radio since its inception in 1988 and have been proud supporters since 1990. During my years leading the Master's Leadership Program, I learned that one of the most important qualities of leadership is listening. Good leaders seek out different perspectives, stay informed, and make decisions based on facts.
And I've seen the same principle throughout my career and years of civic involvement in San Antonio. Strong communities depend on informed citizens and trusted sources of information.
That's why we value TPR. It delivers thoughtful journalism, meaningful conversations, and stories that help us better understand the issues shaping our region.
After the loss of federal funding last year, Texas Public Radio relies entirely on support from community members like us.
If TPR has earned your trust, please join us in supporting the summer fundraising drive. Make your gift today at tpr.org. Thank you.
And you can give us a call, 800-622-8977. Go to tpr.org or use our TPR app. I'm David Martin Davies. You're listening to the Texas Public Radio's Summer Fundraising Drive. TPR belongs to the community that it serves. It is a shared resource built on curiosity, dialogue, and trust. As public media adapts to the loss of federal support, community giving is what sustains the journalism and programming that you rely on every day. The funding that was lost has not been restored, but today the community support helps keep this service strong. And that's why we're working to raise the $250,000 that we need for our budget this summer. And every gift is matched dollar for dollar. And to help us understand more about how all of this fits together, see, I'm not on your side of things, Rebecca. I'm just a guy in front of the microphone. You're out there, really, I think, doing the hard work figuring out how to keep public radio funded. Here's more with Rebecca Cavan, Director of Development here at Texas Public Radio.
Well, it's really our community. That's the truth of who's doing the hard work. And we never get to see that more than during these fundraising drives. The truth is the community's pitching in all year. But during the drives, we really get to see not only through the comments, but the amounts that people donate, big, small, anything in between, pitching in what they can to really help us achieve our goals. So this summer drive, this is only our second summer drive, actually. We launched this last summer after the loss of federal funding, and the community showed up in a big way. And we've come back again this summer because we have to replace those dollars every year now, to ask you to help us raise $250,000. And we're down to a little less than $110,000. We've got $109,710 to go. Right now, every donation that's made is matched dollar for dollar. That's really making the most of all of the dollars that you give right now. So if it's time that you can, we hope that you'll donate by going to tpr.org, using our TPR app, or calling us at 800-622-8977.
You know, when we have these weather events that happen here locally, like we had last year with the July 4th flooding in Kerrville, we saw the community come together and support Kerrville and how that meant resilience, building back stronger. This last weather event that we had, there was more rain, more rainfall, and the flooding was much more severe. But we didn't have that terrible loss of life. We lost some lives, but it was nothing like what we had in July. And because people were better prepared, they understood the seriousness of what happened, and they communicated, and they were just, you know, we were better off. We were able to deal with it. We can deal with harsh weather, and we can rebuild, but those lives that we lost were just horrible stories that we told here on TPR. But I think, you know, the story is like community coming together, community taking care of each other. That's really the big takeaway. And then we can look out for each other. We can build resilience and help each other on these troubled times. And Texas Public Radio was a big part of that. We told the story during the days of those floods and also the most recent ones. We're going to keep on top of it as this severe weather continues. And also everything else that's coming down the line that we have so much we got to cover. We just can't do it without you. You're part of the community. We want your support because it makes it all the more rich to have you. Knowing that you're with us when we're out there doing these stories, it makes a big difference. Give us a call right now. We need your help. 800-622-8977. You can make your gift right now at tpr.org or on the TPR app.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.